kind of hard to miss no matter where you were yesterday, but tens of thousands of people across southeast Michigan and northwest Ohio were mesmerized by this rare total solar eclipse. And they experienced the real deal, the daytime darkness and this remarkable display in the skies. Kevin, my wife, my daughter went down to Luna Pier right at the southern edge of Michigan, right before the Ohio border, and saw the totality. It was amazing. They said they took video of it, and we were, I don't know where you were yesterday at the time. I think you were on a golf course somewhere.
I was not. I ended up in Ferndale at Como's Restaurant because I was driving in that area, and I saw people with glasses on. I said, do you have glasses? They said, come in and order lunch, and you can have glasses.
Oh, is that right?
So I went in and ordered lunch, and I watched for 90 minutes. I watched the whole thing. It was great. I mean, as it first started, I mean, throughout lunch. I didn't just stare at the sky for 90 minutes. But it was really cool to watch it. And as it got closer and closer to totality, it looked like a tornado was coming, or looked like it was going to be the end of times. Not up in the sky, just all around me.
Because it was dim. Things were starting to dim.
It looked like a crazy storm was coming in.
Yeah,
you were driving. Is this, Miguel Cabrera's 3,000th hit? Why do you drive during all the big events?
Well, actually, I thought it was a few minutes later than it actually was. I was trying to meet up with some friends to watch it. By the time I got there, I already had a curve. But here is my takeaway, though. I called my wife, and she was at the time down in Luna Pier. She goes, oh, my goodness, you would not believe what it's like here. It was, like, totally dark. And it was not the case here. And I know we had about 97%, I think, totality here in southeast of Michigan. But that guy we had on from Cranbrook was correct.
Right. He was absolutely right. Rain.
Detroit was 99% totality. But it was so much different than right in the center of the totality, the path of totality, as they like to call it, because it was like it was nighttime out there.
It was really cool here in Metro Detroit. But at the end, when it got right to the end and it was not totality, and I looked around and there was still an amazing amount of light coming from that small sliver of the sun that still existed.
The sun's pretty powerful.
And I was very disappointed. Yeah. I was really disappointed to not have gone somewhere to see the totality because I really would have enjoyed seeing
it. I should have listened to the Cranbrook guy a little bit more closely,
the expert
because what really convinced me not to drive down there, because, you know, we got a ton of work to do, we got a lot of things to take care of during the day, and I thought, you know, if I take the drive down there, it might be worth it, but I'm going to be backed up in terms of workload tonight. I'll be up for it. So I decided I'm going to stay put. I'm going to watch it from here because we got 99%
in Detroit. I'm going to drive during the eclipse.
Well, that was not planned. I thought, I can make it over to my friends. But here's the cool thing. So my wife and my daughter went down to Luna Pier where it was 100%. It was totally dark. My wife told me the coolest stories, and one of them was that she was standing there looking at the eclipse because it was totality, and some guy in front of her drops on one knee. Not to her. Thank God.
And she never came back.
She never came home.
She's living in Luna Pier now.
some other woman dropped to a knee and proposed to this girl right during the eclipse, and I thought, that is such a great way to do it. What a memory. I mean, that he will always remember the day that he proposed, as we all do anyway, but the eclipse amplifies it. And what a remarkable thing. Great idea, buddy. Whoever you are, congratulations.
Congratulations.
She said yes.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. And then, of course, there was the social media with 8 bazillion pictures of people with funny glasses just looking in the sky. Everybody
Sent me yours
to post. Yeah, I sent it to you. I didn't post it. But many people did. And I thought that was fun, too. You talk about feeling connected to community. Like, everybody except for you, you were driving. But everybody else in the world.
There's plenty of people on the freeway.
Everybody else in the world.
I felt very connected to
at the same time.
Buddy, in that Chevy Silverado, I saw you. I felt connected to you, my right.
And, of course, you know, you got to have politics leaking into everything. So Joe Biden had a post and Donald Trump had a post. I thought they were both great. I really did. Donald Trump's post, I don't know if you saw it or not, but it looked like the eclipse was coming, and it was really Trump's big head with his big eyebrows, Trump's head eclipsed the sun, and I think it said, we're going to make America great again or something like that. And then Biden's was great because he was poking fun at Donald Trump, who, when he was president, stood out of the balcony and looked straight into the sun, and Biden went to the same balcony, and he said, hey, this is great to come out and look at the eclipse, but don't be silly. You have to have protective eyewear on. It was like throwing a little shade. Pun intended.
Pun intended, yeah.
Throwing a little shade at former President Donald Trump, and I thought that was funny.
Did Trump look straight at the sun? Because his eyes seemed to be okay. I mean, is that what Biden's claimed, was that accurate?
Look, I tell you, people look at the sun all the time accidentally. You're playing a game of tennis, and you serve the ball, and your eye gets lost in the sun. So it happens
yesterday, I'll be honest, I was driving, and I didn't have my glasses. I went down to Russell's Pharmacy downstairs.
Yes,
you do, actually. You should have gone and got me some glasses. I went down to Russell's Pharmacy. I said, hey, you guys got glasses for the eclipse? No, sir, we do not. I'm like, huh, where can I get some? I never got glasses.
What you do is you drive around Royal Oak or Ferndale, and you say, hey, who's giving away free glasses? Yeah. You go in and buy lunch.
I just follow you next time around. What is it, in 20 years? Go down to Florida, and we'll catch it there when we're, like, in our 70s or 80s.
It was it was great right where I watched, which was no big deal, but there's probably 50 people at the restaurant, and they all were, looking up at the sky at the same time, and they were clapping and hooing and I thought it was cool.
It was neat. It was neat to see the dimming. But what I was going to say was that I was so tempted to stare at the sun because I wanted to see at least a partial eclipse. So I was driving and I didn't look at I tried to do the peripheral vision thing.
You're looking at the sun while you're driving?
No. Peripheral. On the side. I put my head down in the frame of the window and said, I wonder if I look peripherally while I'm staring in front of me at the highway.
Oh, I think the MSP's at the door, Tom. I think they're here.
Yes. Tom, when is it a good time to tell you I had an extra pair of glasses?
Oh, well, that would have been 2 days ago. Yesterday would have been nice. But you know what? It's fine. It's good. My wife ordered some online as well, and I should have just asked her too. So
why are you looking out the window? I'm over here, Tom.
But what I'm saying is that even the peripheral, I did blow it. I will admit it, I blew it. But the peripheral even hurt. I felt like spots in my eyes. I'm like, wow, just not even looking at the sun. You got to be very careful.
Absolutely. Big day in the Oakland County courtroom. The parents of convicted high school shooter Ethan Crumbly will be sentenced today. That's going down this morning as we speak, pretty much.
Yeah.
James and Jennifer Crumbly were both found guilty of involuntary manslaughter for giving the then 15-year-old son access to a gun and failing to intervene when teachers raised the alarm about their behavior in separate trials. I don't know what this judge is going to do. They could be sentenced up to 15 years, I think. Is that right? The prosecutor recommending at least 10 years. I think, Tom, I think I'd like to see them sentenced to time served. They've been in prison for two. They've been in jail for 2 years.
That's what Jennifer is.
Over two years.
Jennifer is kind of saying, listen, can we do some, at least for one of the charges, can we do time served? I've been in prison for a long, or jail.
I think the lesson has been learned. I really do. Not to take away from what the victims are going through.
No.
But these parents, they were not at the shooting. They didn't plan the shooting. No. They were bad parents.
And you can see just by looking at them physically what has happened to them over the past couple of years in terms of their, I think, what they've tried to endure. Yes, they should have done a lot more as parents, but you can see physically the toll that has taken even on them. So you might have a point there. Appreciate it. We are going to thanks for listening. We're going to check in with Adam Carrington up next.
That eclipse really got you.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, that peripheral stuff. The Biden administration expected to issue a proposal aimed at reducing or eliminating student loan debt. Again, Adam Carrington joins us next right here on 760 WJR.
Welcome back to All Talk with Tom Jordan and Kevin Dietz. President Joe Biden announced a new plan to ease debt burdens for over 30 million borrowers. The plan involves expanding federal student loan relief through the Higher Education Act with a focus on targeted initiatives. Tom Biden says this aims to provide relief to borrowers struggling with student loan debt, but does it address concerns about the rising cost of higher education?
Yeah, it deals with interest charge forgiveness if it's up to $20,000 worth of that as well. And the plan strategically announced just months before a major presidential election. Let's go to Adam Carrington joining us, associate professor of politics at Hillsdale College. Adam, nice to have you back. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be with you. Thanks.
It's not the first time we have talked about this with you. This is another attempt by the Biden administration to forgive students student loans. Didn't the Supreme Court already rule on this?
They did on a previous plan, and it was based on a different law, and it was much broader. It covered a lot more people, a lot more money. So the Biden administration is trying to come back and do this again on a smaller scale with a different law, but absolutely. The last time the Supreme Court pretty decidedly smacked a plan like this down and said, this is beyond what the executive can do. This is basically writing law rather than following law. So the question is going to be, do they do the same thing this time, even with a different attempt to justify it?
Well, I think it just goes back to the same legal premise, did it not? I mean, the Supreme Court ruled last time that forgiving the student loan, depending whatever the law was at the time, constitutionally, this move goes beyond what the executive can do. It takes really an act of Congress to do that. Will that be the case this time around, do you think, as well?
I think so. I think the thing I'd want to look at is the administration hasn't put out its particular justification yet. But the Supreme Court's pretty clearly said, and it's done this with other cases, that if there's a major decision that involves lots of money and lots of people's lives and lots of other big factors, it's called the major questions doctrine, that Congress should be making that decision. They are the lawmaking branch. They are the people's representatives to make laws. So I think it would be still a really hard road for the administration to get through with this. And the question, therefore, is it more political to signal to young voters to try to get them to be more excited about the Biden administration? Because I don't think its legal future is that good.
Yeah, Republicans criticize the plan, arguing it's shifting the financial burden of college tuition to taxpayers who did not take out these loans, and they're not wrong. How does this play out with all the various voting blocks? Young voters with the loans probably like it, but does the rest of the voting world?
Yeah, and I think one thing to realize is more people don't go to college or finish college degrees than do. And a lot of the people that do go through college pay their own way, pay off loans. So, you know, there are a lot of people that I think will look at this on not the legal side, but just the fairness and justice side and say, this is a redistribution of wealth to one segment of the population and giving the burden financially to the taxpayer and to people who didn't benefit and weren't part of this process. So I think this could backfire politically, not just legally, for the president, given that it's going to really, I think, enrage a lot of people that already are not very favorable toward the administration because of its other policies.
One of the interesting things they were discussing in this is the idea of wiping out the interest. And I actually can get behind that. I think it would be very helpful to the people who took out loans. It's still not fair to others, I suppose. But should the federal government be in this business of guaranteeing loans rather than having banks do it, who can make a better determination, I would think, on ability to repay?
Well, and I know you all mentioned before I jumped on about higher education reform and how expensive college is. And one of the biggest problems is how pervasive government has been in it, because it gives colleges the incentive to just keep upping the price because the government will bankroll these things. And I think a move to banks, now you would want to make sure the banks are regulated. We don't want a student loan version of what happened in the Great Recession, where banks were really irresponsible. But I think the banks would be the best direct way to do it. And by the way, my institution, Hillsdale, we don't take federal government loans. That's how students get their loans, is through the bank. And it works for us. And I think a well-regulated system like that might be more responsible, and then might force colleges and their spending and tuition decisions to be more responsible.
Well, Hillsdale is one of the very few colleges that do not accept that federal assistance to go there. And what it does, it frees you up, right? You're not bound by all the strings that come attached with federal loans and federal subsidies, correct?
Exactly. That's a way that the private colleges also get at least, not if not controlled, just very much directed by the federal government. And we've made that commitment, and it really is not just a question of, I think, justice for our students and keeping our tuition costs down, but it really is a way of keeping our intellectual independence and then doing education the way we think we should be able to do it.
You know, so the Biden administration, they're using the Higher Education Act of 1965 to as the legal authority for this latest round of attempted student loan forgiveness. Does using that act to switch the burden of paying back the loans to taxpayers, does that square with the act's original intent and the limitations?
No, I think it was meant to make it easier and better for people to go to college and to expand college access. But that is a different thing than changing the terms of how people agreed to go to college and the burdens they took on, the responsibilities they took on. I think it really goes against those principles and, again, goes against how far can the executive stretch and make independent decisions when he's supposed to be applying the law, not making major changes to it. So I think both in what it was trying to do and how it was trying to do it, this goes against both the spirit and the letter. And I think that is the most likely outcome legally when we get this through the court system, as it inevitably will go.
When you look at the timetable, we know the plan is going to be challenged. Will any of this happen before the election, and will it go away after the election?
I think it will. I don't think it's going to go into effect for those reasons. It already takes a long time for this process to go through the bureaucracy, and I think it's going to get put on hold as it's figured out judicially. Whether it ever goes into play will depend on one of two things. One, what the Supreme Court says, or two, the 2024 election. I think if former President Trump's elected, I think this just goes away because he's probably going to revoke it and not implement it. If President Biden were to be reelected, I still don't think it goes into play, but I think that's because the Supreme Court squelches it on similar terms to how the last debt plan went.
And it's interesting because in this proposal, there's, you know, forgiving loans. It describes something as low financial value programs that it would include forgiven loans for those. How does the government plan, do you think, to determine the financial value of an education? And is that the appropriate role of the federal government constitutionally?
Yeah, I will be interested in their standards. I mean, if they want to say that maybe institutions, there's been some talk of this, institutions that have closed down and therefore they don't, you can't go and find the records of your being there, and therefore that may, that the fact that the institution failed financially may end up making the degree less.
We're up against the clock.
Not a thing.
We're up against the clock. Adam Carrington, thanks so much. Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. We'll be right back with more.
Yeah, Kevin Dietz and myself, Tom Jordan, with you until noon today. Hey, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who recently, you know, left the Democratic Party to run for president of the United States as an independent, he's expressing some concern over what he perceives to be the misuse of government power against Donald Trump, his opponent in the race, the weaponization of the Department of Justice. And he pledges, Kevin, to appoint a special counsel to assess the fairness of these legal actions that have been tied to the January 6th Capitol riot.
Yeah, Tom, Kennedy stated that while many protesters on January 6th broke the law, some reasonable people see little evidence of a true insurrection. He emphasized the need for an impartial rule of law and expressed concern about the division caused by both parties using January 6th to demonize opponents. Let's bring in Dennis Darnoy, founder of Denstar Consulting. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Democrats jumped out right away on this, responding strongly, saying they believe Robert Kennedy Jr. is trying to help Donald Trump win the election. They say they think Kennedy knows he has no shot to win, but has decided to try and take votes away from Biden with this stance specifically. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I mean, they certainly feel that way, and they're certainly investing a lot of money to try to prove that case. You know, I think they're concerned that their candidate is not necessarily the strongest candidate. And so when you have someone who, you know, comes in like a Robert Kennedy Jr. and has appeal to people within their base and within their coalition, they are concerned. And look, everyone knows that this is a close race and going to be decided by a few states. So any traction that Robert Kennedy Jr. can get in those states is going to be to the detriment of Joe Biden for sure.
The weaponization of government is a big issue for people. I don't think Americans like the idea of that at all. Donald Trump has said it's happening to him. Democrats have said, no, it's not. He broke the law and he's not above the law. No one's above the law. Does Robert F. Kennedy Jr. come out saying that he has concerns about weaponization of government regarding January 6th? Does that add weight to what Republicans have been saying?
Well, I think it adds weight, but it also, you know, gives yet another voice to that issue. And I think Again, you have people who, both Republicans and Democrats and some independents, who are looking at his candidacy and saying, look, I don't like either choice. Maybe this guy has something to say that I should listen to. And when he talks about these things, he's talking about things that, he's hearing on the campaign trail. He's hearing, about this issue. And there is a concern, I think a general concern among the voting public that some decisions that should be free of partisanship aren't, and they are very much driven by people in positions of power who are saying, hey, why don't we do this? And they're finding justification for it and using legal language to find that justification. But the motivation is to, clearly harm a political opponent.
It's very interesting because Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I mean, he was up until recently a Democrat, but he's spoken out just on a regular basis about how he is against the power that accrues with such a large government and wants it to turn the other way. Do you think that, given the charges against Trump, and then now Kennedy's pledged to do something about what he perceives to be this out-of-control power by a select few, how could the appointment, do you think, of a respected special counsel impact the public's trust in this election process, judicial system, but also maybe sway some opinions about what really happened on January 6th.
Yeah, I think, if he were elected president, and obviously that's a massive if, and he were able to then go ahead and do it as he says, appoint that special counsel, I think what it would allow is, an independent voice, a sort of, again, depending on who he would pick, to give a bit of authority to the issue, and it wouldn't be viewed as through the lens of a Biden-driven DOJ or a Democrat-led special committee, to see if indeed this was something that, as Republicans or some Republicans would say, was a gathering that turned violent and laws were broken, unfortunately, versus a Democrat saying that there was intention even prior to the event taking place, and that this was constructed and led by individuals. I think if history could be clarified and say it was one thing or the other, I think that is what his goal would be, to announce that special counsel.
It's interesting because he's no fan of Donald Trump, and this is not the issue to him. The issue is larger than Donald Trump, and it's larger than Joe Biden, and he's criticizing both of them and both parties in reality for demonizing the various opponents in these parties. What is the solution? How does RFK Jr., what's his idea to fix that problem of demonizing opponents?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to walk the walk when he, through his campaign, and that's going to be very interesting to see as it gets closer into the actual election months, if he's able to follow through on that process. I mean, I think a lot of people would agree that there needs to be a return to civility and discourse in politics. I mean, the constant name calling, the constant demonization on both sides, it impedes progress, and it's why Congress is inefficient and doesn't get things done. It is the reason that political figures have such a low approval rating from the general public. It is the reason why there's so much distrust in government because of the rhetoric that's being used. So he certainly, is on point there. And again, you look at polls and they'll say 70 to 75% of Americans would agree with that statement. So, he's going to have to embody those values and those ideals when he's out there on the campaign trail.
I want to talk a little bit about Trump fatigue. The idea of seeing him in court and fighting all these cases, that it could be too much for swing voters who just want to move on. I don't think I'm seeing that yet, at least not in the polling. Will Trump fatigue pick up as we get closer to the election, or was this possibly a bad strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not certain. I mean, I'm going to agree with you completely there, Kevin. I don't see that happening. I mean, again, there are polls that have said if he is convicted, that may impact, some of his voter turnout or his voter numbers. But I don't think that there's a fatigue issue at all. I mean, everyone knows who he is. He hasn't changed in 8 years. Everyone can pretty much envision what his presidency is going to look like. His support are very, very engaged. He is leading in almost all the swing states at this point in time. So again, they're not really sure that there's going to be a fatigue factor coming into play. His supporters are engaged, and he may gain a few voters here and there, but I mean, those people who are solidly behind him, they're coming out to vote on Election Day.
Yeah. Appreciate, as always, your perspective on this. Dennis Darnoy, founder of Denstar Consulting. Dennis, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too. Did the same thing. Here's what I like about RFK Jr., Kevin. The guy is issue focused. If you go through an interview with him, he will be going through the issues that he cares most about and tries to find ways to solve those issues from his perspective. Now, we might not agree with those, but rarely do you see him go after opponents.
But people really like him in that he says what's on his mind and he sticks to it.
Right.
They find that refreshing.
I certainly hope we go back to more of a healthier discourse where we can debate the issues rather than the personalities of the opponents. All right, more to come. We'll take your phone calls. Love to get your perspective on this as well. It's 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR.
Welcome back to All Talk with Tom Jordan and Kevin Dietz. Your calls are welcome, 1-800-859-0957. You can also text at 1-800-859-0WJR. James and Jennifer Crumbly, the parents of the teenager Ethan, who killed four students in the 2021 school shooting in Oxford, are being sentenced right now. They are in the courtroom waiting to hear their fate. They each could face up to 15 years in prison. This sentencing represents the end of this horrific saga that has set a legal precedent of who could be responsible for a mass shooting aside from the actual perpetrator. Both parents were found guilty in separate trials for allowing their 15-year-old son to have a gun and ignoring signs of his spiraling mental health. Tom, it was the first time the parents of a school shooter have been charged with such serious crimes in this country, even though they did not pull the trigger.
Yeah, the whole gist of it is that they bought the then 15-year-old a gun. He had access to it, and they failed, they say, to intervene when teachers raised the alarm about Ethan Crumbly's behavior in the separate trials. So it's interesting, Kevin. They had separate trials. They will be sentenced together today, and the proceedings are underway right now. They'll be hearing a lot of testimony from victims and victims' families in this. I remember Ethan Crumbly, he pleaded guilty in October 2022 to killing four people. It was a horrific mass shooting at Oxford High School. Seven other people were injured in that shooting as well on November 30th of 2021 at Oxford High School. So
let's listen in, Tom, to some of the testimony.
My position is that this should not be scored at PRD 7, should not be scored at 20 points, because it is one act, not multiple acts. And I don't believe that the sentencing guidelines properly consider the facts of this case. Again, we've never seen a case like this before, and I don't believe that the sentencing guidelines properly consider the facts of this case, Mr. Crumbly's case, or then Mrs. Crumbly's case, to adequately score PRD 7. And I believe it should be scored at 0.
I'm really able to prosecute an information if you'd like to respond.
Thank you, Judge. There is zero support for counsel's argument that PRB 7 should be scored at 0. The case law is clear. The statute is clear. There were four separate homicide counts. Four children were murdered November 30, 2021. Because of that, each defendant was charged and then convicted of a homicide count, involuntary manslaughter, each with its own elements, Judge. We've argued back and forth about was this homicide or was it not. This is why the court issued the rulings the way the court did regarding the video and other evidence regarding photographs of what happened inside the school. The statute is extremely clear. Four separate counts. They don't get to have a scoring of 0 as if three children weren't killed, Judge. It is clear what the law is. It has to be scored at 20 points.
Anything further for information?
No, Judge.
Well, I have reviewed this, thoroughly the sentencing memos that you have submitted, as well as the pre-sentence investigation, the statute and the case law, and I believe PRB 7 is scored correctly with regard to both defendants.
Your Honor, the next suggestion that Ms.
Okay, so if you haven't been to a sentencing hearing before, each side, the prosecutor and the defense attorneys, will argue back and forth what the scoring should be, the number of points that ultimately is decided to be the accurate scoring is what the judge uses to determine how many years or how much time, if any, the sentencing will end up having.
Right.
So it could be up to 15 years. If all the points mm-hmm. go in, the judge is more likely to sentence on the higher end. If some of those points are kicked out on the lower end, the judge in that particular ruling, which was just one slice of the scoring, the judge ruled with the prosecutor.
And in that exchange right there, what we heard was the defense saying, listen, this is one act. It was not multiple acts. And they said this, the sentencing guidelines do not adequately portray this as being the first time anyone like this has ever been charged. This is setting a precedent, and that should be taken into account. There's no precedent to base this case and the sentencing upon. But the prosecutor says, no, it is not one act. This was multiple homicides, four separate murders or four separate charges for each of these. These were homicides, and this was a case that these two should be charged in separate, many different separate counts of this. So that's going to be, to your point, goes right to the way the judge is going to rule how the sentencing should proceed. And based on the case, you have to say the prosecution is correct. These are multiple counts
absolutely.
That they've been charged.
Points for each individual.
Absolutely.
We are going to continue to monitor this for you and bring it to you as it happens. We also have WJR Senior News Analyst Marie Osborne covering this story, and she's going to bring us the latest as well throughout the program today. Your calls are welcome, 1-800-859-0957. Your text as well, 1-800-859-0WJR. Let's go out to Pontiac and check in with Brad. Brad, welcome to All Talk.
Thanks, Kevin. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Great,
great.
So regarding the student loan forgiveness, I'm not sure that I agree with the assumption that Biden is buying votes. Reason is, if I was in a position to have my loans forgiven, I would gladly take the money from Joe Biden and then turn around the next day and vote for Trump. I don't see where there's any
connection,
agreement, or idea that just because I'm getting my student loans forgiven that I'm going to continue supporting this president.
The reason why I think that's the case, Brad, is, I mean, I'm with you. It'd be nice to get a forgiveness of all that debt and whatnot, and then just go vote for the person you care about. But this was a major campaign promise, and I would argue that in 2020, he kind of went over the crest there and being elected. And this is one of the reasons why, that he promised to forgive the loans of millions of young people who are, you know, having to pay them back, and they don't want to do that. So, it was a campaign promise. Two, if somebody came up to, I mean, not everyone is going to vote for him whose loan is forgiven, but the majority, I think, would be persuaded to do that. If somebody came up to you and say, hey, here's $20,000, I'm running for president, I love your vote, you're more likely to vote for that individual who just gave you $20,000 than not. And you can see, this translates to the border issue as well. With all the immigrants coming from various countries, when you see them crossing over and they ask them, why did they come? Well, because we love President Biden, because he invited us to come here. They're crediting him for doing that. And I think that will translate to votes the next time around.
If you follow the polling with young voters, Joe Biden needed young voters. He wanted young voters. He took the Bernie Sanders playbook and he offered student loans. He made a promise, right, and he got the young voters. Then the Supreme Court shut him down. And these young voters did not get the money
that
they
thought. And they were angry about it.
They were very angry. They moved towards Donald Trump. And the polls clearly show that they're irritated and upset, and they're moving towards Donald Trump. And now you see Joe Biden doubling down, saying, I'm going to find a way. I'm going to go around the Supreme Court. I'm going to get you that money, because he knows, they know, they've done the math. They know they need those young voters, and they're losing them in big numbers. Let's go to the text with Laura Hessen. Laura, what do you got for us?
Matt and Chelsea sent a text about the student loans and said they've already pushed some of these through. Forgiveness through. His niece got $30,000 eliminated from her student loans because they were doing teachers and first responders first, but their nephew who works for Ford is now making too much and hasn't gotten any relief.
Yeah, so they're doing it based on income, too, and based on that kind of a need, or perceived need that you have based on how much money you make. And that's going to continue with this. In fact, they're focusing in some elements on this. They're prioritizing certain minority groups over non-minority groups. There's a lot of that going into this as well. The whole bottom line here is that by assuming the authority to forgive student debt broadly like this, the administration may be encroaching on, it's the legislative branch's authority here to dictate fiscal policy. And this is what the Supreme Court ruled last time around. Kevin, I think they're going to take this back up.
It's
sure.
It's a bit of a roll of the dice, really, with the Biden administration. He says he's hoping to help 30 million people. If 30 million people get relief from their student debt, will that equal 30 million votes? We don't know. How many people have mortgages that they feel like, well, those should be paid off? Right. The interest should be wiped out there.
Yeah.
It's not happening. Are more people going to be upset or not? We'll have to find out. We'll be right back with the headlines of the day. You're listening to All Talk on WJR.
Michigan does come to talk, and I appreciate that, Mr. Announcer Man. Sorry for the interruption there. We'll lead off this hour once again with some thoughts about the eclipse yesterday. I found it, Kevin, to be pretty remarkable, even though where we were located was not in the path of totality, as they like to say, the path of totality. But it was about 97% in much of Metro Detroit. So the dimming took effect. Laura Hessen was just describing to us some of the conversations that our afternoon guy, Chris Renwick, had with some little kids about their impressions of the eclipse. And I don't know if Laura, you want to jump in on this, and Danielle, because I think you both heard it. But it's pretty hilarious, the perspective of children when they look at this, you know, astronomical, brilliant thing happening in the sky. What was the general takeaway from this?
There were two little girls. They were sisters, 16 months apart. I don't know their actual ages, but their reactions were so pure. One of them was so into it. She was like, I'm never going to see one of these again. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The other one goes, it was boring.
It was boring.
Well, it's kind of slow.
It gets dark every night in my house.
Right. What's the big deal?
Every day it gets
so
dark.
Something's in front of the sun. That happens every night. That's pretty funny. Yeah. Well, it is very cute, and it's pretty funny. The way that Chris Renwick responded to it was pretty good, too.
Yeah.
So, love it.
Fun kind of scrolling through the social media apps too, just seeing what different people did. Here's a friend of mine, Suzanne Deary. She was in Sandusky, Ohio. Said, made the trip to Sandusky, Ohio for the eclipse. It was more than worth it. I was blown away seeing the eclipse in totality. Unbelievable sight. The sounds from the birds, darkness, and temperature drop. I spent the almost 4 minutes taking all of it in with her son, Joe. I kind of wish I went now. We talked to the expert, and the expert said, you got to go. Just go get to see it in totality, because even though it's 98, 99, 97% here in Michigan, it is not the same. And it was cool. I thought it was really cool.
Was
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was neat. But when it got there and was just short of totality, it started getting bigger again. I'm like, no!
One of the reasons,
why did I just drive
a couple
of hours?
Well, one of the reasons I did not go down is because of the traffic. I knew it was bad. We were listening to Renee talk about traffic all morning going southbound on 75 and US 23 down there. And then I heard Matt Loria from Axiom IT. He was on with Paul W. Smith in the early afternoon, and he called into a show and said, yeah, I thought I was the only one with this great idea to drive down south to Ohio to watch the eclipse. It turns out there were like tens of thousands of others, too, who wanted to do this. So the traffic was horrendous. He had to pull off the freeway, and I thought, yeah, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to drive over to – I had some buddies in Brighton. I thought I might stop off there. I didn't make it to Brighton in time. I was still on the freeway.
And then this post reminded me of you, Tom. This is from Teresa Baldus of the Detroit Free Press.
Yeah.
She said, when you go to the garage looking for solar eclipse glasses and you think you have found them, then realize they're for the Polar Express movie.
Yes.
She ended up making a view box out of a cereal box.
Like three – oh, one of those things, yeah.
So they were 3D glasses for a kid's movie, not exactly the eclipse. So a little preparation in advance will enhance your experience. So next time in 20-some years, maybe you can start planning now, and then you'll have glasses. You won't have to look straight at the sun while you're driving down
I-70. Unbeknownst to me, there are people in this building who had spare glasses, and I won't say who they were, but I wish I would have
known. I can't believe
you
weren't moved by the eclipse while driving in your car without glasses looking out the window.
I almost shed a tear, only because I saw it in my peripheral, and it hurt my eyeball.
Oh, boy.
So, listen, there is some scrutiny a little bit about these sanctions relief to Iran right now. The Biden administration is facing some pretty fierce pushback on the sanctions relief it is giving for Iran amid all these escalating tensions in the Middle East. Remember, Iran is supporting Hamas and Hezbollah with some of that money. So GOP lawmakers on the Senate Banking Committee, they're slamming the administration for issuing this $10 billion sanctions waiver for Tehran. Which unlocks frozen funding and allows the country to access hard currency. So from the electricity purchases which Iraq buys from Iran, but it frees up a ton of money for them. And we know that they fund the enemy of Israel and in many cases the enemy of the United States as well.
In other headlines, a former Michigan police officer admits guilt to excessive force. Matthew Rodriguez, 49, pleads guilty to deprivation of rights under color of law, excessive force used against arresting during fingerprinting and photographing at a Warren detention facility. False statements made in the incident reported by Rodriguez, omitting crucial details of what happened. This was investigated by the Detroit FBI office. Warren Police Department released footage of the assault in June 2023 where injuries were sustained. Rodriguez faces a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison, and he will be sentenced on August the 20th. Speaking of sentencings, we have the Crumbleys in court right now. Marie Osborne is following the case with us and joins us now. Good morning, Marie.
And good morning, guys. So I've been following the case. They started a little bit after 9 o'clock this morning. James and Jennifer Crumley both being sentenced after being found guilty of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter for their role in the Oxford school shooting back in 2021. When the two defendants entered the courtroom, they were both wearing their prison garb, as is standard for a sentencing. They had a momentary glance with one another, but there was no communication between the two of them, and they were sitting between their attorneys. So far in this sentencing, there has been a lot of judicial minutia, if you will, happening because the objections are being voiced over the pre-sentencing memo or the guidelines or the reports that are prepared by the Michigan Department of Corrections. And there's a lot of different things that they talked about today that the defense attorneys had took exception with in the report. But one of particular interest was that there was a piece in there that said that the two of them, James and Jennifer Crumley, could not have any contact with their son, who would also be in the Michigan Department of Corrections. He, of course, admitted his guilt and his role in the shootings and the killings. He was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole. So there was a lot of back and forth here about will they be able to in some way be able to communicate with their son if they want. According to the sentencing report, that will not be allowed. But they're trying to get that changed. And it was interesting because the judge said, you know, we've never encountered this kind of problem before, this kind of issue. I don't even know if I have the legal standing to make a determination on this. It may come from the Michigan Department of Corrections. So it's interesting that the Michigan Department of Corrections says that these defendants, whenever two people convicted of the same crime go to prison, they are considered enemies and therefore cannot have any contact with one another. So, and that would technically be the case here. So they're trying to change that. They'll have till the end of the month to get that in. One last thing, we are expected to hear victim impact statements today from each of the youngsters who died, but we'll hear those and maybe a couple others, but there will not be the number of victim impact statements that we heard during the Ethan Crumley sentencing. So that we are still expecting.
While both parents face up to 15 years, they're likely to get different sentencing. Yes. Was there an indication from the trial who may have been more at fault, him or her?
They were simply found guilty of manslaughter, 4 counts of manslaughter. Let me lay that out for you too. They are facing the 15 years that's on the books, but the prosecutor has recommended a sentence of 10 to 15 years. The defense attorneys are looking at more like 5 years apiece, but they want the time served because, you know, they've been in prison for 2 years now, over 2 years. So they'd like to have that credited as time served. The state has recommended a sentence range of 43 to 86 months. That's about 7 years for each of the parents. We'll see shortly what the judge rules on that.
It's coming down. We're watching it along with you. Thanks so much. WJR Senior News Analyst Marie Osborne. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So the push for reparations in Detroit continues. Will Detroit deliver on this opportunity? We're going to speak with the co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force, Keith Williams, up next on 760 WJR.
Welcome back to All Talk with Tom Jordan and Kevin Dietz. Detroit has established a reparations task force to address historical injustices faced by black residents. The task force aims to rectify harms caused by discriminatory practices such as overassessed property taxes, housing discrimination, and displacement. However, the task force, Tom, has faced many challenges, including internal disagreements, resignations, and public criticism.
A lot of practicalities are having a hard time coming to fruition. In this. Let's go right to the co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force, Keith Williams, joining us. Keith, nice to have you. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
How you guys doing?
Fantastic. Good to talk to you today. Let's get right into it. I mean, the task force was developed some time ago. There's been some significant struggles with some administrative issues, even some resignations that Kevin touched on. What are the challenges that you see as the co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force in concluding the what you've set out to do?
You know, I'm going to say this to you. You know, just like any organization, you're going to go through some hiccups. In the beginning, you bring in all these different diverse attitudes and intellect to the process, and you got to merge that stuff. You just look at Detroit Lions. When Dave Campbell came, in the coach, he had to go through some stuff, and now guess what? And now they're on the trajectory of winning. That's the same thing with the Reparation Task Force. We're on our way to winning, okay? Yes, there was some hiccups, but guess what? The light is shining, okay? We got University of Michigan in doing a harms report. We brought Columbia University in with Howard, and they're doing the impact report. And so I think the future is bright, and we're going to get the job done.
You know, discrimination is, you know, a pretty complex issue. It's historically complex, and it's different in Detroit than maybe it was in Chicago or Los Angeles or wherever. Being Detroit-specific in this call for reparations, how can what you're asking for accurately address, you know, the varied experiences, maybe even within your city?
Let me say this to you. The problem you have, you got the federal issue, then you got the local issue. The local issues only address those harms that was caused locally. The only way we fix this thing is the federal government do what they're supposed to do. Just like they get Japanese reparations, they should give African Americans reparations for slavery and the richness that they benefit from. And so on the local level, we go back. There was some form of slavery in Detroit, but the majority of the harm is when black folks came from the South and went to work for Ford Motor Company, supposedly for $5 a day, and they only got $3 a day. And from that community, we had to have housing, and we was moved to Black Bottom. And I found in my research from 25 to 29, 1925, 29, 50,000 brand new homes were built and black folks couldn't live in them. So it's systemic. It has moved towards the future, but at the end of the day, we can only do what we can do on the local level. But what we're going to do is going to be sound and it's going to be effective when we send in the report.
How do you, if you can, balance the need for addressing current inequalities rather than past injustices?
Well, you can't. First, you got to fix the past before you can go forward, as you know, and so. You know, we could take it one step at a time, but if you look at the language says to set up a task force to make recommendations on housing and economic development. And so housing has been a major problem from 1929 to the present day. Okay. And so once we fix the housing, then the other aspect of economic development, how we make the pot include African Americans in the city of Detroit. And that's going. The task force can only make recommendations. I want people to understand this. We can only make recommendations. It's up to them when we finish the report. We're going to give it to the city council and the mayor, and it's up to them to take our report and do something with it.
What are some of the ideas being floated around that are likely to make it to recommendation form?
Well, we are going through a process. People are throwing a whole lot of stuff, man, and so I'd rather get things going, get something concrete, and come back to you guys with concrete stuff instead of just start wishless throwing it out there and confusing people. You get confusing people when we should be, you know, talking about how we bring it to fruition.
How do you quantify what maybe would be a fair, you know, amount that you might give? I mean, if you look back at the historical discriminations that have been endured by African Americans within Detroit and really across this country, how do you quantify that? What would be a fair amount, do you think, and how would you come to that amount?
Man, everything is based on housing value. As you know, housing is where all your wealth is created. And the housing value in the 1900s was $6,000. That was added, and then you fast forward to the present. Man, it could be, it's hard to quantify something like that, but you could do it based on property value. And we just started owning homes after the 1950s. So it could be in the billions, man. It could really be in the billions.
Some people are worried about a lack of transparency. I think transparency is really important. Do you think that it's a good idea to do your work quietly behind closed doors, and then present at the end? Or do you think that people should be able to see what you guys are talking about and what you guys are doing as you do it?
We got subcommittees. We're on Zoom. There's a schedule on the website about when the subcommittees are meeting. My committee is finance and economic development. We got housing. We got education. And we got culture. They all they got to do is go to the website. The reparation task force, and you'll get that information when we're meeting. And we ask them to be engaged, just like every person of the month. We've been having community meetings. We're going into the community and, you know, just taking the live testimony and get people's opinion. So we are out there. We are engaged with people. And we are putting it out there on our website. I'm doing a lot of talking. We're talking up, we talk this thing up, but we just need people to get engaged and come to the meeting.
The reality on the ground, you look at the city of Detroit and some of the things that they are facing, and you look at significant economic and infrastructural challenges. How would this realistically play out? By allocating resources to reparations, is that the best use of what's already limited funding when there's already immediate needs like education and public safety remain in some cases unmet? How do you square those things together?
If we can find tax breaks for the billionaires, then you can find money for reparations.
What's the timeline? When is the committee report due? How lengthy will it be? How detailed will it be? Will it point out all of the things that took place and all of the recommendations to have reparations for that?
Well, let me say this to you. Our report, we're contemplating October when the report would be done, but we have extended it. If we need more time, we can go to March 2024. But we're on pace to get this job done.
Yeah. So extending the deadline, you think that's going to help you out here? Get this all these pieces together.
If we need it.
Okay.
We got 7 months. We can. I believe that we can get the job done. We got some very capable people on the board who come from academia, come from business, and I think we can get this done.
Are you looking at straight cash payments, or is there possibility of land or other assets?
Me, I've been talking of land. Cash payments, you know, there's some significant problem with cash payments. Not a significant problem with cash payments, but you got to look at it from an inflationary standpoint. So we have an economist named Tony New Reeves, and he's helping us from the macro and the micro level. How does reparation fit in from that, from an economic standpoint, okay? We got to be realistic. We're going to be realistic about that. But at the end of the day, you can't pay for the damage was done to us mentally and the wealth that was lost from historically. So we're going to get this together. All I ask the citizens of Detroit to have patience. Have patience. We got some capable people going to get the job done. It's going to be thoughtful. It's going to be realistic. And more importantly, the folks in the city of Detroit are going to be happy with
Keith,
the result.
Keith Williams, co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force. Keith, thanks so much. Your call's next, 800-859-0WJR.
Welcome back to All Talk with Tom Jordan and Kevin Dietz. The number is 1-800-859-0957. You can give us a call or a text, 1-800-859-0WJR. How many people have been following the work of the Reparations Task Force? They're working on a report report to come out in October asking for potentially billions of dollars and possibly land for harms caused by discriminatory practices in the past, such as overassessed property taxes, housing discrimination, and displacement. They are going to give their recommendations. We just talked to Keith Williams, co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force. They're going to give their recommendations to city council and ultimately to the mayor of the city of Detroit for a final determination in how much, if any, money and land will be given to African Americans in the city of Detroit. 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR.
Yeah, Keith Williams, we spoke to the co-chair of the Detroit Reparations Task Force, and he says this is absolutely necessary and needs to be done within the city of Detroit and also around the country. The federal government needs to step in and make sure that reparations do proceed and they come to a conclusion with potentially billions and billions of dollars giving to the African-Americans in this community based on historical discrimination that has occurred. What do you think about this? Love to hear from you again. It's 800-859-0WJR. We'll take your text messages there as well. Also, the Crumbleys, the parents of Ethan Crumbley, are being sentenced today. They could be seeing up to 15 years in prison. Do you think that's enough for them? Should they get more? Or maybe it's time served. They've been in jail, remember, for about a couple of years, just over that right now as it stands. And so their defense is asking, at least in Jennifer Crumbley's case, you know, listen, can you at least give her time served? It's been a rough go for the past couple of years. Or should she at least get 5? Maybe it's 10. Maybe it's the full 15. Love to hear from you, 800-859-0WJR.
Yeah, the probation department, which is supposed to give an unbiased assessment of what the sentencing should be, recommended 7 years. Typically, in cases, you will get time for time served, so that would bring it down to about 5 years. What do you think is the right number, or should they be released now with time served, the 2 years that they've already done? 1-800-859-0957. Let's go out to Livonia and check in with Mark. Mark, welcome to All Talk.
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment on that. They can't just walk out of jail now. I mean, they got to do every year or so just for closure for the family. Mm. And the reason why I'm saying that, because I went through this. Oh, I got to go.
Bye. All right. Okay. Appreciate your call. Mark in Livonia calling in.
Priorities.
Yeah, I can see why he's saying that because, you know, listen, this was a horrendous act that had occurred. And the impression that I would give if the judge said, all right, time served, you can walk out of the courtroom today, I think a lot of people would be upset. And the pushback from the victim's families might be pretty severe on that. But then the full 15, I mean, where do you stand in the middle of that?
I have concerns about parents being charged for the crimes of their kids. I have some concerns about, you know, whether the people who did the act are those who should be sent to jail or not. But in this case, I said I want to let the system run its course. I have faith in the system, and they were charged. They were convicted by a jury. I didn't sit through the trial. I clearly, from covering it and talking about it, we know that these parents made a ton of mistakes and did not step
right
in when they could have.
They were not good
in
parents.
They were not good parents, not by a long shot. So I like that the convictions send a message to people,
yes,
that you better pay attention to your weapons. You better not let your kids have access. If your kids are struggling with mental health issues, pay attention, because that's good for kids. That's good for families. That's good for everybody that people be doing that. I like the message. I don't know if 15 years in prison will get the message across any more than the 2 years that they've already served or not.
Here's, you know, when I first heard this argument this morning, we were listening live in on this sentencing hearing, the defense was arguing, listen, this is essentially one count. I mean, there are four people who were killed, but there's no previous case to guide the judges and the prosecution on how to sentence parents for their child's mass shooting. And her argument is basically Jennifer had no control over how many people Ethan killed. It could have been one. It could have been 300. She had no say in the matter. So should she be charged and sentenced based on the number of people that someone else ended up killing? Or should it be just a basic, she was negligent as a parent? and it led to this tragedy. I think that's what they're trying to make, and it's a very difficult argument to make when there's no precedent that has ever been set.
Would it be different? And maybe it wouldn't be. I don't know. But if Ethan went home at lunch and took his parents' car keys and drove back to that school, and he drove through the recess and tried to kill as many people with a car that he could. And would they say, why did you allow your kid to have access to a car? You knew he was not doing well mentally. Right. You should have got him out of school and got him to a doctor, and you allowed him to have a deadly weapon. That country singer was just charged this morning with throwing a chair out of a window from, I think, a sixth
story. But he threw the chair.
I know, but they called the chair a deadly weapon. So a gun is a deadly weapon. Gotcha. A chair is a deadly weapon. A car is a deadly weapon.
A car certainly is a deadly weapon. In fact, police can shoot back because if a suspect is approaching them in a car, they can shoot him because that's a deadly weapon.
Hey, but Mark's back from Livonia. He got his crisis straightened out. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick point because back in 2017, I was interviewed by Frank Beckman on the 50th anniversary of the riots. And, you know, my father was killed in 68. And, they finally caught the guys, and they were pretty bad dudes. They robbed 100 stores and killed 4 people and all that. And so they did catch him. But, you know, to let somebody out of jail, like, right away, I think that they should do a little bit of time just to get some kind of closure, because that's a rough one, I mean, to handle.
Well, sure. Ethan, though, is going to be spending a lot of time in life, you know, essentially. He's the one that did the shooting. But what do you think about that degree of separation between him and his parents?
Well, the problem I had with that whole thing was they ran to the bank, and then they hid at that warehouse.
Yeah. Right.
So were they trying to hide something? And that's the only thing that stinks about it. But I can make one quick comment, too, on that reparations. You know, I lost my dad during the riots, mm-hmm. He was killed for $100. He owned a little grocery store. Mm-hmm. And those guys, you know, that did it, am I going to get reparations? I was 12 years old at the time. He was 41.
Wow.
He just came back from World War II, opened up a little business, and it was over for him. And so, you know, what about all the other reparations? You can't change the past. You just can't. And there's no money that can buy changing the past.
Yeah. That's really, really sorry to hear about your father. That's a terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that and your opinion there. Let's go to Florida and check in with Chris on the same topic. Hey, Chris.
Hey, just wanted to comment on the reparations issue. There's one thing that's missing. I understand there's been redlining and discrimination in Detroit for years, going back in the 60s and beyond. But what's really happened is there was a drug attack on Detroit after the riot in 1967. That riot destroyed this community. That's why you see so many abandoned houses, lost real estate wealth. That drug attack was financed by the U.S. government. It's been well documented. And Contras, the whole drug running and gun running, ended up destroying the city of Detroit. Reparations are due for the thousands of bodies buried under this city based on the government's actions. And it's all been confessed to. The drug runners have confessed to it. They were paid by the CIA to return drugs to the country after they ran weapons to the Contras. That's where the reparations should start. That's much deeper than redlining, because this is lives lost. This is families destroyed with drugs that swamped Detroit in 1970, 1969.
Yeah.
It was instant.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Chris, in Florida, calling in. Chris, appreciate your perspective. Got to run here real quick. More to come, 760 WJR.
Welcome back to All Talk with Tom Jordan and Kevin Dietz. Michigan election officials and law enforcement officers are participating in training sessions across the state. What are they preparing for? Potential disruptions during the upcoming presidential election in 2024. These sessions include tabletop exercises where hypothetical scenarios such as bomb threats and suspicious substances and absentee ballots are discussed to develop strategies for responses.
Yeah, so are they hypothetical? Is this something that is more, in fact, realistic? Let's go to Tina Barton, former Rochester Hills city clerk, joining us to talk more about this. Tina, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin and Tom. Glad to be here.
So break it down. What's going on? What are you training for?
Yeah, so you mentioned some of the items. Certainly, we are looking at things like physical threats to election officials, physical threats to the workers that are out there working the elections, but we're also looking at threats to the process. Anything that would cause a disruption or delay in the actual processing of ballots or the processing of any type of the election process. We're working through things that will allow the election officials to kind of evaluate or create a continuation of operation plan if they don't already have one. If there were to be something that would happen, that they would have some sort of a crisis communications plan. We talk about AI, how that might be used to disrupt the process, considering things like insider threats. If there were to be an insider threat issue, how would you work with police to kind of evaluate that and investigate that, determine where it came from? We do talk about the unknown substance, as you mentioned. We talk about acts of disruption, intentional or unintentional. That could be someone actually doing something to disrupt it, or it could be, you know, a pipe burst at their polling location and they have to change the location. So again, intentional or unintentional. We also talk about swatting, what that might look like for an election official if they were to be swatted or their office were to be swatted, what would that look like? And we talk about voter intimidation too, and what roles we're expecting as election officials for law enforcement to play in any of these scenarios, and then legally, what roles can they play or cannot, and where can they be and cannot be? And we talk about, as we're walking through these different scenarios, what does that look like too for chain of custody in that type of an event? What would that be, chain of custody for evidence for law enforcement, chain of custody for things pertaining to the process, like the equipment, the ballot, all of that. So lots of really good conversation that's taking place, and people walking out of there, we're hoping with their eyes wide open as to these are some things that could happen. I think it's important too to point out that these scenarios that we present are not sensationalized. I heard your question at the beginning, is this something that could happen or something might have already happened? As we're putting scenarios together, really we're kind of picking things from the headlines that we're seeing all across the country. For instance, the unknown substances, that's something that we saw in, you know, at least five different states over the last 6 months, where some sort of an unknown substance has been sent in through election type mail. So we talk about, like, how would that impact the process, you know, contamination? What does that look like for their chain of command? Should their main election official be exposed to a substance that kind of takes them out of commission? So We walk through all of those different areas with them, and again, hoping that they're walking out with a plan in place or at least some conversations to take back and bring stakeholders in their own community together to have some more in-depth conversation.
Oh, yeah. There's been incidents. We know that. And we know that in some of those envelopes, I think there are about a dozen envelopes, that some of them contain some fentanyl, like trace amounts of fentanyl in them. None in Michigan that I'm aware of. I know there was a backpack that was left in Linden that some thought might have been a bomb, so they checked that out. There was no threat there. How widespread? I mean, I know there are incidents around the country, but how widespread is this? Like, for example, in 2022, the midterms, how many incidents occurred here in the state of Michigan?
I don't have an exact number for the state of Michigan. What our goal, though, is to certainly that if it happens in 2024, that they're prepared for that to have happened because they've already walked through these exercises. I think one thing too that's really important to point out is tabletop exercises are very common for public safety, law enforcement, fire, emergency managers. That's what they do, right? Election officials, this has not been something where they've actually been brought to the table in the past. You see a lot of training that goes on around schools, even houses of worship. And now we're looking at elections as, hey, this is a major event that happens in our community that we should be prepared if something were to go sideways, that we have a plan in place. And election officials have not traditionally in the past been a part of any tabletop exercises. So this is kind of something new for them. But I think that we have, at least in this time that we're living in now, where there's so much division politically, it seems that the rhetoric has really kind of heated up and when it comes to things around elections and election officials have become targets. that I think that it's really important that we're now bringing everybody, all the stakeholders and communities together and say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this very large planned event that we have that goes on in our community and is going to happen multiple times this year and make sure we're prepared no matter what happens.
So this is the first time there's been proactive training with law enforcement. I've seen some of the training they do like this. They'll use real scenarios from the past. Is that what is happening with you folks? Are you using real scenarios from the past? And if so, can you share some of them?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we're using scenarios that have at least happened in places across the country. For instance, when we talk about the bomb threat and swatting, there's certainly reference to looking at Georgia and the bomb threat that they had. And then that very same evening, the chief operating officer of Georgia's elections, Gabe Sterling, had his home swatted. So we talk about scenarios like that. You look at Maricopa County, Bill Gates, when we talk about physical threats to election officials, number one, I'm telling my own story, right? But then also pointing to Bill Gates there in Maricopa County, where his family had to be put into hiding because they were threatening to kill him and threatening to rape his daughters. So there's we're using very real life situations, again, using mine of what happened to me. And if this were to happen to you, what steps would you need to take for your own personal security? And then again,
what are some of those proactive measures that people could take to prevent incidents like this?
Well, certainly for their own personal security, doing things like, you know, changing up their route to and from work, doing things like not putting on your vehicle where your kids go to school or what sports teams they play. A lot of these are like common sense things that we don't really think about, not having a vanity plate, things that make it easy for people to find you, going on Zillow, having your pictures of your home removed off of there so someone who may be targeting you can't see every single access point to your house and know where every single room in your house is and what it looks like. Very common sense things. You know, also having that the conversations with your staff and your team of what that might look like if someone were to come to the counter and they're becoming very verbally aggressive, and keeping track of really if you're seeing the same individuals come in and over, and if their behavior is escalating, making sure you're reporting that to law enforcement, your local law enforcement, but also making sure that you're letting your FBI election crime coordinators, which we have fabulous election crime coordinators in the Detroit area who service the state of Michigan, making sure that they're aware too, because this individual who could be causing you problems could also be causing problems in another county or even in another state. And by making sure your FBI election crime coordinators are involved in those conversations, you can help if someone is kind of, again, like the person who threatened me did that from the state of Indiana.
Thanks so much, Tina Barton, Rochester Hills City Clerk. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next, we're going to talk basketball, the NCAA Men's Championship game. Stay with us on WJR.
Victim impact statements are underway right now at the sentencing for the parents of the convicted high school shooter, Ethan Crumbley. He's going to be sentenced this morning, sometime today. It may not be this morning. They're going to play this out, listen to all the victims and their statements and how this has impacted this life, this horrendous mass shooting at Oxford High School on November 30th of 2021. It's happening right now, Kevin, in Rochester Hills, and it's really it's a precedent-setting case because this is, as we've mentioned, the first time in the United States that parents will be held criminally responsible for a mass shooting that's been perpetrated by their child.
In other headlines, Detroit City Council passes $2.7 billion budget moments before midnight. I honestly do not know if there's significance to the moments before midnight. Sometimes when I hear a headline like that, I think, Tom, that, they got this through in the middle of the night. It could have been a deadline that right. It had to come in before midnight. I don't really know. Mayor Mike Duggan proposed the 2025 fiscal year budget of $2.7 billion with $1.46 billion allocated for the general fund. The budget aims to increase spending in areas such as police and fire departments, retirees, homelessness, transportation, and elections. City Council approved some of the mayor's proposals, including a $20 million boost for the Detroit Department of Transportation to hire more employees. Both the fire and police departments expect to hire more personnel as well to enhance public safety efforts. Council member Fred Durrell III highlighted that the budget reflects residents' concerns and significant progress for the city. The budget includes 100 in $1 million in one-time spending supported by last year's surplus. I don't know if that $101 million will go to the general fund or not. This is all kind of just breaking news because it happened just before midnight. I haven't had a chance to dig into it, but I would like to talk with somebody who's following this closely.
Yeah, airlines are planning some mass layoffs as well, and it's raising some doubts about customer service. I don't know if you've noticed, but the customer service, I guess, sector of various industries is kind of being trimmed. If you go around to various fast food restaurants and whatnot, but the concern is with American Airlines. They're planning to cut about 650 customer service positions, ostensibly for the enhancement of the customer experience. People are saying this seems kind of counterintuitive. So what role is artificial intelligence playing in this? And I think this is the direction maybe some feel that it's going. This is a high-stress arena of air travel. There are a lot of complaints, especially if there's a delayed flight or a canceled flight, and can leave passengers kind of feeling abandoned in terminals at times. So what they end up doing is they talk to customer service. So if those people are going to be cut, what is their replacement? And I guess artificial intelligence might be the solution to it. So they're looking into that. And but again, more layoffs in the airline industry.
Following former President Donald Trump's statement on abortion on Monday, former Vice President Mike Pence issued a statement of his own on X, formerly known as Twitter. He said, "President Trump's retreat on the right to life is a slap in the face."